the summer with these four gentlemen, although I'll mention some closely related work in the course of the talk. So throughout this talk, I'll discuss Euclidean quantum field theories in three dimensions. And the talk has roughly three parts. In the first part of the talk, I'll define Trent-Simons contact terms and discuss some of their properties. And in this part of the talk, I will not rely on supersymmetry. And in the second part of the talk, I will then specialize the discussion to the case of supersymmetric n equals 2 theories with an R symmetry and explain what kind of supersymmetric Trent-Simons contact terms arise in these theories. And this will lead us to a new anomaly in three-dimensional superconformal field theories. It'll be an anomaly, it'll essentially be a superconformal anomaly, although I'll explain in more detail that it'll be an anomaly that represents the clash between superconformal invariants and the compactness of the R symmetry. And finally, in the third part of the talk, I'm going to apply this understanding to clarify several facts about the partition function of these supersymmetric n equals 2 theories on a 3-sphere, which in turn will lead us to a very simple and straightforward proof of F-maximization, which has been conjectured and widely used, but not carefully established. And it will also lead to new tests of proposed dualities, which I'll explain at the end of the talk before concluding. So let's start with something extremely basic. In field theory, contact terms are simply correlation functions of local operators at coincident points. So in quantum field theory, local quantum field theory, correlation functions are allowed to have delta functions and derivative of delta functions in these correlators. And here, C and C prime are just some numbers. And throughout this talk, it will be extremely helpful for me to couple every operator inside to a classical background field, to a classical source. So I'll couple O to some classical source lambda, and then I'll specify a Lagrangian for both the dynamical fields and the background fields. So I've indicated that here. Here's the coupling of the source to the operator O. And here I've indicated various terms in the Lagrangian, which are pure background. And you can see that if you want to compute this two-point function of O, you have to take the derivative with respect to lambda twice. You can either lower the operator O twice and get something at separated points, or you can differentiate these terms here. And that simply gives these delta functions a derivative of delta functions with the appropriate coefficients. So that's old news. And why do we not talk about these contact terms very much in field theory? The reason we don't talk about them much is because they're, in some sense, not very interesting. They're completely, pardon me. Pardon me? No, I'm saying I can summarize this contact term by such a term in the effect of action.
And then drop the way they produce the coefficient.
If you want, yes. Yeah. Or if you want, you know, adding such terms to the action will produce this addition to the correlation function in addition to whatever I already have. So this will become a bit more clear in the examples. So the reason we don't talk about them much is because they're not universal. They're arbitrary. And this can be seen from several complementary points of view. Clearly, they reflect short distance physics. They reflect the shortest distances that are accessible in quantum field theory in the coincident points in delta functions. And as such, they depend on how you cut off the theory. They depend on the scheme, the regularization scheme. And in line with what I just said, they can be modified by changing the local counter terms of the Lagrangian. And also, if you do field redefinitions of either the dynamical or the background fields, this also changes the contact terms. So these are highly scheme-dependent non-universal quantities in general. However, there are a few situations in which contact terms are meaningful. And this happens whenever there is a physical principle, for instance, a symmetry, most importantly, that restricts the allowed counter terms. Okay? So perhaps the simplest example is the Siegel term in scalar QED, which ensures current conservation. Perhaps a more pedagogical example is the trace anomaly in 2D CFT. So in a CFT, the trace of the energy momentum tensor is what's called a redundant operator. So its correlation functions vanish at separated points. But this doesn't mean that it can't have any contact terms. So if you insist that the energy momentum tensor be conserved, then this forces the trace to have non-trivial contact terms. And this is simply the statement of the conformal anomaly in two dimensions. One way to make this more manifest is to couple the stress tensor to a background metric. And then imposing conservation of the stress tensor is equivalent to demanding diffeomorphism invariance under background coordinate transformations. And the contact terms in the stress tensor are summarized by this famous formula, where C is the Virasoro central charge and R is the background Ricci curvature. And this formula cannot be changed by adding diffeomorphism invariant counterterms. Okay? So these are situations in which the contact terms are completely fixed by symmetry. So far we have encountered situations where they're completely arbitrary and situations where they're completely fixed. And what I want to talk about here is a third situation where they're sort of in between. And these are these Chern-Simons contact terms that I'll now define. So if you consider a three-dimensional field theory with a global U1 flavor symmetry, and for now we'll assume that the U1 is compact. And all that means for flavor symmetry is that all, that the charge lattice is integral, that all the charges are integers. And in line with my previous comment, I will immediately couple this conserved current to a background gauge field, little a mu.
Sorry, can I ask something?
Yes.
The previous slide, is it obvious that C, that this C that appears in the anomaly,
oh, sorry,
is related to a contact term? Why is this C the same C as the one in the previous
slide? This C is not the same C that appears in this slide, but it is a contact term. And the way to see this is take this equation and take another derivative with respect to the background metric. Then you bring down another insertion of the trace in this correlator, so you have two traces. And when you differentiate this with respect to the background metric and then restrict flat space, you just get some derivatives of delta functions. So this is just the statement that, that in flat space, that two-point function of stress tensors has a derivative of a delta function multiplied by C. Yeah. It's a bona fide flat space conic term. Okay, so the two-point function of these U1 currents is allowed to have a contact term of this form, which is completely consistent with current conservation. If I hit this with a derivative, it's clear that this epsilon symbol kills it. And the I is, because we're in Euclidean space, K is a real number in a unitary theory. And if I want to write the corresponding term in the background fields, then this is simply a Chern-Simons term for this background gauge field, little a mu. So this contact term is summarized by a Chern-Simons term in the effective action for the background gauge field. And that's why we call these Chern-Simons contact terms. So let's try to see what happens if we run the previous logic with the counter terms on these Chern-Simons contact terms. So the previous logic was that contact terms are arbitrary because I can change them arbitrarily by adding a counter term with some coefficient delta kappa. Okay, so if I want to change the contact term by some delta kappa, I have to add such a counter term to the UV Lagrangian. However, it's sort of, you can take it as a postulate or as a physical principle that counter terms, due to the fact that they summarize local physics at short distances, due to the fact that they summarize very massive physics, have to be completely local. And what that means is that they shouldn't be sensitive to whether you put the theory on some globally non-trivial space, or whether you study the theory in the gauge background of some non-trivial bundle for little a. So I want this counter term, in order for it to be a valid counter term, I want it to make sense on any manifold, and I want it to make sense for any gauge background field little a. And that leads to the quantization of delta kappa by the familiar argument for the quantization of Chern-Simons terms, except that the logic is slightly different. Here we don't integrate over little a in the path integral, so we don't need to worry that integrating gives a bad quantum theory, but we have a different argument that good contact terms still require quantized delta kappa. Good counter terms, sorry. So because this delta kappa is quantized, the ambiguity in kappa is quantized. And that means that its fractional part is not modified by the addition of counter terms. So the fractional part of kappa is a good physical observable that is scheme independent. And this observable would be the hero of the talk. Just a few technical comments. In order to carefully define the Chern-Simons term in the presence of non-trivial gauge bundles, we should extend both the three manifold we're considering and the gauge bundle to some four manifold. And the quantization condition on delta kappa follows by demanding that
this extension shouldn't affect the answer. Okay? And something that will become clear in one of the examples I'll discuss is that occasionally, consistency of the theory requires us to add a certain fractional counterterm in the UV. I'll explain that in a little bit. But even if that's the case, the integer part of delta kappa is still arbitrary. So I'm always allowed to shift delta kappa by integers. OK, so let's explore this in a little more detail by looking at the current correlation function again here in momentum space. So just if I take the current two-point function in momentum space in any quantum field theory and I impose current conservation, I find that it has this form. It has two tensor structures, one sort of the usual conserved tensor structure and one that looks a little Chern-Simons-like. And I have here two-dimensional structure functions, tau and kappa, which are functions of p squared divided by some mass scale. And in a CFT, there is no mass scale, so these tau and kappa must just be constants. Okay? So in particular, in a CFT, kappa is always a contact term. And in a unitary field theory, tau is positive. This will be important at some point later in the talk. And now let's discuss a little bit what corresponds to separator points, what corresponds to contact terms. So because of this p in the denominator here, tau always corresponds to separated points in position space, if I Fourier transform back. So tau is always a good physical observable and it's scheme independent. Similarly, the p-dependent part of kappa also give rise to a contribution at separated points in position space. So it's also physical. But shifting around kappa by a constant is exactly the contact term that we discussed on the previous slide. Okay? And so now we can sort of just make a list of what are the interesting observables associated with this correlation function. Tau is always a good observable. The p-dependent part of kappa is always a good observable. But the constant piece in kappa deserves a few more comments. So it is natural to define the UV and the IR limit of this function kappa with these subscripts UV and IR. And then adding a counterterm, as I did before, shifts kappa UV and shifts kappa IR, but it shifts them by the same amount. So their difference is always physical. So you should imagine that there's some function kappa of p squared, which is completely physical. The difference between its endpoint is physical. And by adding a counterterm, I can just shift it up and down. However, if the U1 symmetry is compact, we can say more. Okay, if the U1 symmetry is compact, then the ambiguity is quantized, as I discussed. And then both the fractional part of kappa UV and the fractional part of kappa IR are physical observables. OK, some examples. This is the simplest example one could come up with, just a free massive Dirac fermion in three dimensions. This has a global U1 symmetry under which the fermion has charge 1. Yes?
Can the non-fractional part the integer part jump in the
UV? Pardon me?
The integer part cannot jump in
the UV. So as I said, the difference between kappa UV and kappa IR is physical, and it cannot be affected. But you can change them overall by adding an integer, both of them the same integer, though. Yeah. However, this difference may be bigger than an integer. It's not that kappa UV minus kappa IR has to be fractional. Okay, so maybe I'll comment on this at the end of the slide and give you an example where that happened. So in this example, it's just very easy to compute this function kappa of p squared. It's just a one loop integral. And you find that the difference between kappa UV and kappa IR, which I argued is physical and scheme independent, is a half times the sine of the mass. Okay. Now, if the infrared theory is completely empty, as in this example, it's just a trivial field theory, then we call the theory fully gapped. And the effect of Lagrangian of this fully gapped theory in the infrared is simply a pure background Chern-Simons term for the U1 background field. There are no more dynamical fields left. And its coefficient is simply kappa IR. And the same argument that told us that valid counterterms had to have integer delta kappa tells us that a trivial quantum field theory should have integer kappa IR. Because it's all coming from massive short distance physics. So the same quantization argument applies. And if we demand that kappa infrared is an integer, then this equation, which is unambiguous, tells us that the kappa UV must be a half plus an integer. And this is a phenomenon first observed by Redlich. And the fact that consistency forces you to pick half-integer kappa uv is sometimes referred to as the parity anomaly. The reason it's called that is because, in particular, since it has to be half-integer, it cannot be zero. So you break parity by the addition of this background Chern-Simons term in the UV, even though the UV theory is massless and, on the face of it, doesn't seem to break parity. And you can see now that if I add, you know, a bunch of fermions and I integrate them out, then I get a half for each fermion. So in particular, I can get any integer or half integer I want if I choose the masses right. Okay. So here's a slightly more interesting example. It's a purely topological theory.
It's a theory of a dynamical U1 gauge field, big A, with Chern-Simons level K, and a background U1 gauge field, little a. And I'll couple little a to this topological current of the dynamical gauge field, big A, with this integer coefficient P. And Q here is also an admissible integer. And this Q here simply reflects what I would call a properly quantized UV contact term. So this integer here is properly quantized for the background field. OK, so let's see what happens in this theory. Naively, if I, you know, don't worry about the fact big A is topologically too much, I can just integrate it out, the Gaussian theory, at least naively. And then I find an effective Lagrangian for little a, the background field, whose coefficient kappa is Q minus this fractional combination here, P squared over K. So again, this Q is just a properly quantized contribution, but K, the Chern-Simons coefficient of the dynamical gauge field, makes a fractional contribution. The fact that this contribution is fractional shouldn't bother us. The theory is not inconsistent because we've done something illegal. We've integrated out a topological gauge field. Nevertheless, this is the correct value for the contact term, kappa, corresponding to this current. So we see that topological, even very simple topological field theories, can give rise to fractional contact terms. In fact, this fractional contact term plays a prominent role in the fractional quantized Hall effect in condensed matter physics. And there's a close parallel between all of these contact terms that I'm discussing and various Hall conductivities and viscosities. But I won't go into that in any detail.
But I didn't understand the statement. Why was A not integrated out properly?
Oh, because I simply treated it like a Gaussian variable. I didn't integrate, or I didn't take into account fluxes and things like that. Mm-hmm. See that that the fact that I obtain a fractional kappa here means that this Lagrangian is inconsistent for certain configurations of little a. Mm-hmm. So you might ask what happened. Well, it turns out that if you make a configuration of little a such that the flux is such that this would be naively inconsistent, then if you go back to the original theory and you integrate out big A, it turns out that when you take into account the flux sectors carefully, there's a certain constraint that you cannot satisfy, a certain Gauss law constraint. In fact, then the effective Lagrangian would just be zero. So the inconsistency is removed if you integrate out big A carefully. That's all that this comment is to signify. It shouldn't be perturbed by this fractional kappa.
In this case, where the U1 is dynamical, is the integer part of kappa physical?
No. Sorry, there are two U1s. There's a dynamical U1 and there's a background U1. The background U1 corresponds to this global symmetry coverage. This is a global symmetry. And I'm talking about the kappa corresponding to this global symmetry. I will only ever talk about kappas corresponding to global symmetry.
So you can drop Q.
You can drop Q. I just included it to make manifest the fact that I can always add any Q I want by fixing the UV coverage. OK, last comment. It perhaps deserves some discussion about why these contact terms and correlation functions are observable at all, or whether they're observable. I argue that they're physical and scheme independent, but are they actually observable? One way of observing them is to make the background gauge field little a dynamical, actually gauge the flavor symmetry. And then you can study Wilson lines in flat space, Wilson lines of little a in flat space, and the correlation function of Wilson lines will be something that involves the linking number and also this coefficient kappa. So kappa can be determined from studying such correlators. Later I'll present other observables that will also allow you to extract kappa. Also the fact that it corresponds to a Hall conductivity is pretty suggestive that it might be measurable. So my third example is sort of a prototype for the theories I'll discuss later in the talk. This is an RG flow with two crossover scales, big M and little m. And I'll imagine that the UV theory is free. So this is an asymptotically free theory. And the IR theory below the scale little m is completely gapped. And again, by completely gapped, I mean there are no topological degrees of freedom. As we saw from the previous example, topological degrees of freedom are important, and they can contribute to these contact terms. So we need to keep track of them carefully if we're discussing these contact terms. And we imagine that between the free UV theory and the MTIR theory, the theory flows close to some perhaps non-trivial interacting fixed point. And then we can use the fact that we know what kappa has to be in the UV and what kappa has to be in the IR to learn something about the kappa in the middle, the kappa of the CFT that we flow past in the middle. So kappa UV is fixed by very simple principles. It's fixed up to an integer by just counting the number of fermions. You get a half for each fermion, and also adding up any decoupled topological contributions that we may have. In the IR, kappa must be an integer because the theory is fully gapped. And up to the integer that I'm allowed to fiddle with in the UV or in the IR, kappa CFT is then completely determined, and it's an intrinsic observable of the CFT that I flow past. So this is sort of another way of arguing that the fractional part of kappa CFT is a genuine observable of the CFT, should be regarded as a property of the CFT. And finally, even though I'm not going to talk about it much, we can repeat the entire argument that I've given for global U1 currents. Of course, we can generalize to non-abelian flavor symmetries, that's trivial, and we can also generalize to two-point functions of the stress tensor. These also admit a contact term of this form, some coefficient kappa g. And this contact term simply corresponds to a Chern-Simons background term for the metric that couples to the stress tensor. So it's this combination in the spin connection. It looks like a non-abelian Chern-Simons term for the spin connection. And the quantization condition, again, follows from the argument that counter terms have to be local. And more precisely, it follows by extending or defining this term by extending the metrical four-manifold and demanding that the answer be independent of how you do the extension. So the entire story completely analogous. And these also represent interesting observables that haven't been discussed much. So that was the first part of my talk. And now I'm going to move on and see how all of this works in theories with supersymmetry. I'll be discussing n equals 2 theories in three dimensions, so theories with four supercharges. And in these theories, we must distinguish between U1 flavor symmetries that commute with supersymmetry and U1 R symmetry. Okay, so if a flavor current, a global flavor current, is embedded in what's called a real linear multiplet together with two scalar operators, one operator k of dimension 2, one operator j of dimension 1, j in three dimensions has dimension 2, and then there'll be some fermions, which I'll sort of omit in this discussion. And we can couple this current to a background gauge field, which sits in a vector multiplet. As usual, there's a gauge field, there's a D term, and in three dimensions, there's also this scalar sigma. Sigma couples to k and v couples to j. And the only thing I want to emphasize is that now since v is a background field, d, which is usually an auxiliary field, can take arbitrary values. So you don't integrate it out using its equation with motion. That's important. And once I know that, I can just generalize the previous discussion. Very simply, I just have to find the supersymmetric completion of the Chern-Simons term for little a. And we'll call this the flavor Chern-Simons term because it arises in the correlation function of two flavor currents, and it contains the piece that we already know, and also some term like proportional to sigma d, which is new. And what this term means is that this contact term, kappa flavor, that appears in the correlation function of two vector currents also appears in the correlation function of the scalars j with k. These are related by supersymmetry. And the same quantization argument as before shows that the fractional part of kappa flavor is physical if the U1 symmetry is compact. R symmetries are more interesting. So in a three-dimensional n equals 2 theory with a continuous R symmetry, the R current is embedded in a supermultiplet together with the supersymmetry current and with a stress tensor. And we studied these multiplets in some detail in the paper with Nani from last year. So the operators in the R multiplet are these. Most of them will not be important for us. I'll just highlight the R current here. This is the supersymmetry current. This is the stress tensor, and these are two additional operators, which I can discuss in more detail. you would like me to. And then we need to find the appropriate background field to couple these currents to. And the appropriate background fields sit in a supergravity multiplet, in a particular supergravity multiplet, which I'll call the three-dimensional new minimal supergravity multiplet. It's a particular formulation of three-dimensional off-shell supergravity. And it contains a bunch of fields, one for each operator in the R multiplet. So there's a gauge field, which couples to the R current, big A. There's a gravitino, which couples to the supersymmetry current, the metric, of course, and two more gauge fields or fluxes, which couple to the other operators in the R multiplet. V will appear in various formulas. V is simply the dual field strength of this gauge field C. So in conventional supergravity, dynamical supergravity, the fields A, H, and V are auxiliary fields, and you integrate them out using their equations of motion. They're determined by the matter structure of the theory. But here again, as in the case of the flavor symmetry, I will not integrate them out. I will treat them as classical backgrounds, and I will allow them to have arbitrary classical configurations. One important comment for later, if the theory is superconformal, then the trace of the energy momentum tensor, as well as these two operators, jz and jmuz, are redundant, which means they vanish in correlation functions at separated points. And correspondingly, the operators in the supergravity multiplet that couple to them, like the Ricci tensor, which couples to the trace of T, or this linear combination of A and B, or H, which couples to these two operators, they can be gauged away in conformal supergravity. So these are fields that we do not really expect to appear if the theory is conformal. Okay, so I've given you a lot more background fields, so now we can write a lot more Chern-Simons terms. So
sorry, but I thought that the point was that they appear in Chern-Simons-like terms.
Which ones?
The ones you said that will not appear.
Oh yes, I'll come back to that. So, but naively, the expectation is that in a superconformal theory, we should be able to get rid of this. And that'll be an important exception.
Given the first part of your talk, we should not be naive. No?
Very good. So this will be indeed sort of the essential point of what I'm going to come to. So let us write all the Chern-Simons terms that we can given our new gauge fields. We can, of course, write a gravitational Chern-Simons term, as I've already discussed above. And we can now write a mixed Chern-Simons term for the flavor symmetry and the R-symmetry gauge field, and also a pure R-symmetry Chern-Simons term. So we have three new guys. And if we complete the gravitational Chern-Simons term with a supersymmetric expression, then it is perfectly superconformal. And superconformal, one of the ways you know that is that this combination A minus 3 halves B appears here, which is the one that survives in superconformal theories. And this term was studied long ago by Martin Rorschach and Peter van Oenhuizen. And it's pretty much what we expect. But the other two Chern-Simons terms are more interesting, as Pedro already intuited. And for example, a contact term in the mixed two-point function between flavor current and R current corresponds to a supersymmetric Chern-Simons term of this form. Okay? It has some coefficient kappa flavor R. It has, of course, the expected Chern-Simons terms for the flavor current and the R current, and has various other operators, or background fields, rather. However, it's obviously not conformally invariant. It contains all the fields that I told you shouldn't appear in a conformal theory. It contains A minus a half B, contains H, and it contains the Ricci scale. So these are fields that do not arise in conformal supergravity, and they're fields that couple to operators that should naively be zero in a conformal field theory. And the same is true of the RR contact term in the two-point function of two R currents. So, of course, this will lead to some trouble. So let me briefly summarize before getting to the trouble. We have four supersymmetric Chern-Simons terms, a flavor-flavor term and a gravitational term, and a flavor-R term and an RR term. And the first two have conformally invariant supersymmetric completions, but the last two do not. Okay? So this, as you may anticipate, leads us to a problem, more precisely an anomaly. If both the flavor and the R symmetries are compact, then I've argued above that the fractional parts of the various contact terms are physical and they cannot be changed. They cannot be removed. For the superconformal ones, of course, this is not a problem. They can be there, and we expect them to be there. But for the non-conformal flavor R and RR contact terms, we have a problem. We want them to be absent in the superconformal theory, but we cannot remove them if the appropriate kappas have fractional parts. Okay. So the question is what to do with these non-conformal fractional kappas. And this is the classic statement of an anomaly. I mean, an anomaly is just by definition a situation where you have different physical requirements, which you would all like to impose at once, and you can't do it. So you have to give up on one of them. And the requirements we would like to impose in the superconformal theory are, of course, supersymmetry and conformal invariance, and in line with the whole discussion in the beginning, the compactness of all the flavor and R symmetries. This is not a far-fetched demand. For example, if you start with a free Lagrangian description in the UV, as you often do, you can always pick a basis of currents such that all the symmetries are compact. But if the flavor R and RR terms are fractional parts, you have to give up on one of those. Okay? So the question is, which one do you give up on? The conservative answer would be to give up on this whole compactness issue. This is sort of the new guy, and we might be tempted to get rid of him. So we could try to give up our whole discussion of quantization and what you can and cannot do with the fractional parts, and just add appropriate Chern-Simons counter terms with fractional coefficients to get rid of them. But then, of course, you give up on something. You give up on invariants under large gauge transformations of the background fields. Okay? And in particular, this means that you don't actually lose the observable kappa. I've argued that kappa is an observable, so you shouldn't be able to get rid of it by just adding a counter term. If you try to add a counter term with fractional coefficient to get rid of kappa, you seem to have completely eliminated it from the theory. But the way it shows up is you compute the partition function in the presence of a non-trivial flux, and then you do a large gauge transformation. And then the partition function is no longer invariant, but it has certain modular properties. It transforms by a phase that exactly is sensitive to the kappa you removed with a fractional Chern-Simons counter term. Okay? You've just hidden kappa in another interesting way.
Is it measurable or it's better
defined? It is measurable. So either you don't remove it and then it's clearly there, or you try to remove it because you don't like the fact that you have broken superconformal invariants. What happens then is that if you look at the effective action or the partition function in the presence of a non-trivial background gauge field, and you do a large gauge transformation of this background gauge field, then because you have included in the effective action a fractional Chern-Simons term, the partition function will pick up a phase whose coefficient is exactly sensitive to kappa. So this is the way that kappa is encoded in the theory, even though you have added a counter term to remove it from correlation functions. So it doesn't show up in correlation functions anymore, but it shows up in the large gauge transformation properties of the partition function. Oops. Okay. And I want to also comment that this situation is very similar to the familiar framing anomaly in pure Chern-Simons theory that was discovered by Witten. There, the situation was that Witten was trying to define a topological theory, so he was trying to basically set the correlation functions of the stress tensor to zero. However, if you compute in Chern-Simons theory using some regulator, for example, a Young-Mills regulator, you find that indeed at separated points, the correlation function of the stress tensor is zero, but you can have non-trivial contact terms in the stress tensor correlation function, exactly the contact terms that we have. And if you want a genuine topological theory, you want to set these to zero. So what he did is he actually added a certain fractional Chern-Simons term in the spin connection to cancel these contact terms. But then he paid a price, exactly the price that under large changes of, under changes of frame in this case, the partition function was no longer invariant. This is sometimes interpreted as a gravitational anomaly, but here we see that it's closely related to the discussion we've had above. I should also say that sometimes it is more natural to insist on compactness of the symmetries. Sometimes it's actually more natural to give up on conformal invariants in a certain restricted sense. It'll be restricted because these Chern-Simons terms can only affect a few correlation functions. They don't show up all over the place. But sometimes it is more natural to insist on compactness exactly in the situation I discussed before when you start with the free UV theory. There it's very natural to work in a basis where all the symmetries are compact and just see what comes out in the infrared. And if they're fractional terms, then that's okay. You're prepared. You know that they're there, and you can deal with them. And that's, in fact, something we're going to do later. So let me give one slightly non-trivial example of this whole discussion. The example is just the two-dimensional super QED, and three-dimensional super QED, I'm sorry. So it's just U1 gauge theory with NF flavor pairs of quarks and antiquarks, or electrons and anti-electrons. But I'll also include a dynamical Tripp Simons field term for the gauge field. So this will have level k. And in the infrared, this flows to a CFT, which is labeled by the integers k and nf. So if we start with zero contact terms in the UV and the compact symmetries all around, then we can just compute explicitly what the contact terms will be in the infrared CFT. And the first non-trivial contribution arises at two loops. So you have to do some two-loop computation. We'll work in the limit where k is large, but nf is fixed. And at two loops, you get these contributions to the flavor-flavor term and the flavor-r term. And of course, there will be an infinite power series of higher-order contributions. And we also expect the other two Chern-Simons contact terms to be non-zero, but we didn't compute them. So the flavor-flavor term is perfectly fine. It's a superconformal observable. And you've computed the first order. But the flavor R term, of course, violates conformal invariance. So the fact that this term is non-zero and fractional, because we're working at large k, remember, means that the anomaly I've discussed is actually present in this theory. Okay? And again, you can remove it by adding appropriate counterterms, or you can just live with the fact that you know that certain correlation functions in the theory will not be conformally. Okay, now before I start the third part of my talk, let me make a brief digression. In the third part of my talk, I want to apply this understanding of Chern-Simons contact terms to supersymmetric field theories on a three-sphere. I'm going to take one slide to just make a few general comments about supersymmetric theories on curved spaces. So this has been, of course, a very active area of research in the last couple of years, and some of you have participated in it. One approach to studying these theories in general is that if you want to define a rigidly supersymmetric theory on a curved manifold, you can start more generally with a supergravity theory and then send M Planck to infinity in such a way that you freeze the supergravity fields in some classical background configurations. And this gives a convenient formalism for discussing supersymmetric field theories on fixed backgrounds. This was sort of clarified by Professor Chern-Zeiberg last year. And let me be a little more explicit and discuss the example that we're actually interested in, three-dimensional n equals 2 theories with an R symmetry. Here I've said that the supergravity fields couple to the operators in the R multiplet, and I've written these couplings here at the linearized level around flat space. So H is the linearized metric, which couples to the stress tensor. And again, we have the gravitini coupling to the supercurrents, and these various gauge fields coupling the various other operators in the R multiplet. And rigid supersymmetry exists if you can consistently set the gravitini to zero. So this is very common. You start with a supergravity theory, then a supersymmetric background corresponds to a background where you consistently set the gravitini to zero. And in particular, this demands that the supergravity variation of the gravitini must be zero. So the supergravity variation of psi and psi tilde is some expression in the other background fields. It involves a spinner parameter that parameterizes the supergravity transformation, and it involves all these background fields, of course, the metric, but also A, V, and H. So setting these variations to zero amounts to a partial differential equation for the supersymmetry parameter. And if you solve this partial differential equation, then you have found a three-manifold that admits a rigid supercharge. So every solution of this partial differential equation gives you a rigid supersymmetry. So studying the solutions of this PDE gives you a systematic way of analyzing which three manifolds admit rigid supersymmetry. And they also give you the appropriate background fields that you need to turn on these spaces. And then you can just plug back into the supergravity Lagrangian and immediately obtain
a supersymmetric Lagrangian with the appropriate transformation laws. So this gives a very streamlined, unified treatment of the whole subject, which essentially bypasses a lot of the difficulties that were encountered in the literature. If you work on a case-by-case basis and you want to sort of study each manifold individually, this allows you to basically sort of attack the problem of what are all the possible manifolds that allow you to put some supersymmetry in one go. And I've written a few papers on the subject, both in four dimensions and now also an upcoming paper in three dimensions, mostly with Guido Fasucha and also with Nadi Seiberg and Cyril Closet and Zohar Komorgotsky. And in particular, this one, which is about 3D, should hopefully be out in a week or so. So now let me come to the actual third part of my talk, which is theories on the three sphere. This is, of course, a venerable example that has already been studied a lot in the literature. But I will use this supergravity formalism that I discussed in the previous slide to discuss it, and in particular to relate the discussion to what we have done in flat space. So it's known that an n equals 2 theory with an R symmetry can be placed on a 3 sphere in a supersymmetric way. And this was discussed by all of these people, most recently by Kapustin, Willett, Yakov, Jeffress, and Hama Hosomichi Lee. This is perhaps not surprising for a superconformal theory, because you can always do a conformal transformation to take you from flat space to the 3 sphere. But it is a little surprising for a non-conformal theory. A non-conformal theory on a 3 sphere, if you do the Lorentzian continuation of that, you would just get a supersymmetric theory in the De Sitter space. And these theories are famously known not to exist. So the caveat is that they do not exist if you want the theory to be unitary. And indeed, as we will see, putting a supersymmetric non-conformal theory in a 3 sphere requires you to violate unitarity in a certain way. So if I want to discuss this from the supergravity perspective introduced on the previous slide, I fix the round metric on the 3 sphere. And then the other supergravity fields that I have to turn on in my Lagrangian are fixed by demanding that I have 4 supercharges, or in other words, 4 solutions to this partial differential equation that determines how much rigid supersymmetry is present. And it turns out that if you're on a round sphere of radius r, then all you need to turn on is this background gauge field h, that one here, that couples to a certain scalar operator in the R multiplet. However, you have to turn on an imaginary h. And this imaginary value of h violates unitarity. Okay? So this is consistent with what I just said. In general, supersymmetry on a sphere requires a violation of unitarity, unless the theory is superconformal. If the theory is superconformal, then we said the operator that couples to h, this jz, should be 0, should be redundant, and it should be decoupled. It should decouple, and unitarity should be restored. So this is the only source of unitarity violation in the theory. And of course, as before, this will not quite work in the presence of the Chern-Simons terms we've discussed, but I'll come to that in a second. One more comment that deserves to be emphasized is that in a non-conformal theory, there's no canonical choice of R symmetry. If you have flavor symmetries lying around, then you can always mix any one flavor symmetry into the R symmetry. And a convenient way of formulating this is to turn on a complex background gauge superfield for the flavor symmetry. So you can turn on a certain d and sigma component for the U1 flavor symmetry. And then the real part of the sigma is just a real mass term, just like in flat space. But the imaginary part of sigma is exactly this parameter t that mixes the flavor and the R symmetries. So this will be a convenient formulation to vary the R symmetry in the partition function. And if the theory that you're studying flows to a superconformal theory in the infrared, there will be one particular choice of R symmetry, which is the one that appears on the right-hand side of the superconformal algebra. So there's a preferred value t star, which gives you the superconformal R symmetry. And if you would like to know what it is, you'd have to determine this value t star. So that's an important problem. So let's make a few comments about the partition function of n equals 2 theories on the 3 sphere. It can be calculated exactly using localization. I will not discuss it in any detail. But the only thing that I will need is that it is a function of this background gauge, complex background gauge field sigma, which has a real mass m here and the imaginary value that determines the R symmetry mixing. And most importantly, the answer you get is a holomorphic function of sigma. It's a very nice property that was uncovered by Jeffress. And in a unitary field theory, the partition function on a three-sphere must be real. This is an immediate consequence of unitarity, and it has nothing to do with whether the theory is parity invariant or not. So,
what do you mean by unitarity in a manifold where you don't have time?
Oh, it's the usual notion of reflection positivity in Euclidean signature. That there's an involution of the space that that takes the action to its complex conjugate. Okay. Even in flat space, if you go to Euclidean signature, you have to define some appropriate analog of what unitarity means, and that notion is reflection positivity, and this notion generalizes immediately to spaces like the three-sphere.
But it's a really important requirement of three-sphere.
Pardon me?
Is it a really important requirement of three-sphere?
What do you mean?
Unitarity is a preservation of probability. That's you have to secure, but on three-sphere, I don't know what you mean by.
My ultimate goal is to compute quantities in a superconformal theory on a three-sphere. And if I put a superconformal theory on a three-sphere starting from flat space, I will obviously obtain a unitary theory if I start with a unitary theory in flat space. So it is important for me in order to get consistent answers to maintain
unitary. So that's the consequence of the unitarity on the flat space?
Yes. However, as I've argued now, at some point in this procedure, on the three-sphere, you break unitarity. So the whole question will be, can you recover it appropriately in the end? Okay, so that's in fact exactly what I just said. To preserve supersymmetry, we must turn on this imaginary H, and that violates unitarity, and hence there's in principle no reason why the partition function couldn't be complex. But in a superconformal theory, H should decouple, and the answer should again be real. Okay. And of course, the problem is that if you do an explicit localization computation in many examples, you find complex answers, even if the theory is superconformal. So this is a puzzle. And of course, by now, it's not a surprise that the resolution of this puzzle will be the presence of these Trent-Simons contact terms. And we found two of them in flat space that were not superconformal. And unless we remove them by adding bare counterterms, they will be present. And even the superconformal field theory in the infrared has these non-conformal Trent-Simons terms. And if I substitute the complex value for H, and also the complex value for sigma that I turned on, into these non-conformal Trent-Simons terms, they have no reason to decouple because they're not conformal, and this is what accounts for the phase of the partition function. Okay, so the phase of the partition function is related to these Trent-Simons terms, and in particular, it's completely computable and controllable by using flat space information. The Trent-Simons contact term coefficients, these kappas, are flat space observables. They're real. They can be computed. In principle, you know what they are, and you know exactly how they show up in the three-sphere partition function. So now, even though the partition function looks complex, and in principle you might be afraid that you don't know what you're doing, you can isolate exactly what is the non-conformal contribution and which terms violate unitarity. So you can separate those out. And if you compare explicit computations in flat space with localization computations on the sphere, you find perfect agreement. What's interesting is that the anomaly I discussed before, which was in flat space a clash between compactness and superconformal invariance, is now a clash between compactness and unitarity. Because unitarity is related to superconformal invariance, unless the theory is superconformal and the invariant, this non-unitary agent doesn't decouple. So that means that if I retain non-conformal contact terms, I will violate unitarity. So this is a different way of stating the clash that constitutes the anomaly. And finally, one point which I would really like to emphasize, because it's a common misconception, is that the phase of the partition function, as I've discussed, is due to these Trent-Simons contact terms. And it's not due to a framing anomaly. So it's often said that the phase of the partition function is a consequence of the framing anomaly for Trent-Simons terms. This is not what happens here. This is a different phenomenon. Okay.
So I'm a bit confused by
that.
So it is not the case that the Trent-Simons terms are canceling the phase that was previously found. No,
that's right. That's right.
Okay.
The previous computation was fine. It was correct, and there's nothing that you need to do to it. You just need to interpret it correctly. And in particular, the framing anomaly only arises if you add a certain fractional Trent-Simons term to the UV theory in order to make the Trent-Simons theory topological. We haven't done that. We haven't added anything to the UV theory. And in our examples, there's no framing anomaly. So the origin of the phase is conceptually different.
So unitarity is broken.
If I don't add any counter terms to cancel the Chern-Simons terms, unitarity is violated by these terms. The rest of the theory is fine. It's just these background terms that violate unitarity. This is very innocuous. These are just some terms in background fields. So that's what I want to stress. It is a violation of unitarity, but it's not very dramatic, and it's completely under control. And this control will allow us to now extract a few important consequences with complete confidence that we know what we're doing. So what I would like to do is to use this understanding to explore the free energy on the three-sphere as a function of this R-symmetry parameter. And I will do it in the vicinity of the superconformal point. So in the vicinity of the superconformal point, I can use superconformal invariants, except for the cases where I know the superconformal invariance is broken by the anomaly I discussed. Okay? So the real part of the free energy is an extremum at the superconformal point. And this is naively, quote unquote, obvious, because taking one derivative just lowers a local operator into the path integral, and the one-point function of a local operator in a CFT is zero. So this is the answer you would have expected all along. However, you would have also expected this to be zero, because exactly the same argument applies. Here it is not so. This was a very puzzling feature from the very beginning of this story. And the answer is that the first derivative of the imaginary part at the superconformal point is exactly proportional to this kappa fr, which is one of the conformally violating Chern-Simons contact terms. So here the fact that this is not zero is explicitly a consequence of the superconformal anomaly. And moreover, now that you know this formula, you can use localization to compute the left-hand side and hence this contact term. So we have a new procedure to compute the contact terms exactly using localization. And then you can also study second derivatives, these are in some sense less dramatic, but now that you have complete confidence that you know what you're doing, you can just use superconformal invariants, because the Chern-Simons contact terms cannot affect these second derivatives. Taking the second derivative of the real part essentially just gives you a two-point function of flavor currents, and it's proportional to this tau, this two-point function coefficient of the flavor currents, but with a negative numerical factor. And that means that this extremum that we found here is actually a local maximum. So this establishes F-maximization, which was conjectured by these authors. And again, the second derivative of the imaginary part gives you a Chern-Simons contact term, but here it's the conformally invariant flavor-flavor term. So we have proven F-maximization, and we've also given a procedure for computing various interesting observables in the superconformal theory. So let me make a few comments. Of course, F-maximization allows you to determine the superconformal T. This is what it's been designed for, and also the free energy of the CFT. It is closely related to the F-theorem, but I will not have time to comment on that in any way, although many of you are experts on this, so I will not go into it. Moreover, as I've just said, by examining F and its derivatives near the superconformal point, we can compute these flat space observables exactly using localization. So there's much more information in F than just its value at the superconformal point. You can study all of its derivatives, and it contains interesting information about the correlation functions of the superconformal field theory in flat space. And these are exactly computable using localization. And finally, there's a small non-renormalization theorem that I would like to mention. If you explicitly do the localization computation, you find that this free energy F doesn't know about superpotential couplings at all. And since I can compute this tau and these kappas by just taking derivatives of F, it's clear that they also cannot depend on superpotential couplings. So this is sort of a non-renormalization theorem for these observables. Okay, and the last application is to tests of dualities. So there are many conjectured dualities between three-dimensional theories with n equals 2 supersymmetry. These are always, pairs of theories that are conjectured to flow to the same interacting fixed point at low energies. So there are all these examples, mirror symmetry, Aharoni duality, Gibbs-Monge-Tassel duality, and many more. And one test of these dualities is to compare the S3 partition functions of these theories. There are also many other interesting observables, like the supersymmetric index, but we'll focus here on the S3 partition function. And this has been done by many, many authors. And what you find in all examples is that the results almost agree. They don't perfectly agree. They only perfectly agree if you add to one side of the duality a Chern-Simons contact term. And moreover, you always find that this Chern-Simons contact term that you have to add is properly quantized. It's an integer in the appropriate units. Okay? So this gives you sort of a generalized anomaly or parity anomaly matching argument. There was a parity anomaly matching argument introduced in these n equals 2 theories by these authors. This generalizes this vastly, and it basically says that, of course, dual theories have to have the same kappas up to an overall integer, because that depends on the UV definition of the theory and its currents. So this, in some loose sense, constitutes a three-dimensional analog of a Tofft anomaly matching. It's perhaps not as easy to implement because the kappas are much harder to compute than anomalies in four dimensions. Particularly, they receive all orders and non-perturbative contributions. They're not just one loop, but nevertheless, it's conceptually somewhat similar. And just write down one formula so that you know we actually did something. So if you do this in the example of Givon-Kutazov duality, which is a duality of UN gauge theory with some quarks, and the UN gauge theory with some other quarks and some mesons, and both have a non-trivial Chern-Simons couplings, then you can compute the relative Chern-Simons contact terms directly in flat space. Here it's actually easy to do because you can start with a theory with zero Chern-Simons terms. In a theory with zero k, it's clear that there cannot be any Chern-Simons contact terms because they violate parity. And then you can just do a simple one-loop computation to get the Chern-Simons contact terms in theory with k. And then you compare to the exact localization computation, and you find exact agreement. You find that the term that you have to add to the S3 partition function is of this form. These are these one-loop coefficients that you computed in flat space. And this m and this sigma are real masses and Fayoliopoulos terms, which are just the background gauge fields that couple to the various flavor symmetries. So if you add this correction, the partition functions match. And what's nice about this is that, of course, it's a non-trivial test of the duality, but it also shows us that our understanding of the contact terms is really correct. That the fractional parts are intrinsic observables that come out, in some sense, automatically correctly, but the integer parts are sensitive to how you define the theory of the UV, and sometimes you need to add such a correction term in the UV in order to make the duality agree at contact terms also. So that brings me to my conclusions. So I started by saying the contact terms are not universal in general, and I presented Chern-Simons contact terms as an interesting exception to this lore. Because they are described by Chern-Simons terms for the background fields, their ambiguity is subject to certain quantization conditions, and that means that their fractional parts are observable and universal. In supersymmetric theory, some of these Chern-Simons contact terms were not conformally invariant, and this led to a new superconformal anomaly in these theories, which is something that perhaps a little bit unexpected. Generally didn't believe that there were conformal anomalies in three-dimensional field theory. So this is a sort of conformal anomaly. It's a superconformal anomaly. Finally, I discussed the rigid supersymmetric field theories on the three-sphere. So I want to emphasize again that rigid supersymmetric field theories on curved manifolds can be systematically analyzed using background supergravity. One application of this sort of philosophy is our study of the theories on the three sphere, where we identified a certain imaginary supergravity field that we had to turn on to preserve supersymmetry, and in the presence of non-conformal Chern-Simons terms, this imaginary supergravity field led to complex three sphere partition functions, violations of unitarity, etc., even in superconformal theories. But once we sorted this out and isolated these contributions, we could go ahead and give a simple proof of F maximization. And we presented a way to compute various interesting observables, including the Chern-Simons contact terms, using localization. And finally, we gave an analog, three-dimensional analog of the Tofft anomaly matching conditions, which gives new non-trivial tests of dualities. So that's it. Thank you.
Questions? So, not the same P, F is maximal, F is extremized.
Yes.
Is there any sense of which other can be converse? So if you have an extremum of F, do you, I don't know, should you feel, you think you should feel that it's probably a safety?
So definitely not an extremum. So
I mean, a maximum.
If it's a, so I'm not sure about this, but I don't know of a simple example where you have a theory that gives different maxima, that gives several different maxima. So in the examples I know, F maximization, with the maximization part being key, is enough to single out the superconformal R symmetry. Of course, there's always the caveat involving accidental symmetries. Right? Once you have accidental symmetries in the IR, these are not accessible via this R symmetry shifting procedure in the UV, and then you need a different tool. This is certainly not very well understood. But yeah, but in the absence of such issues, I think F maximization seems to give consistent answers.
But at least in principle, without considering specific examples, this F is much more complicated than this cubic polynomial of.
Yes, F is much more complicated
so
than this.
So in principle, there might be some rubbish.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So F is a much more complicated function of T than the cubic anomaly polynomial in A maximization in 4D.
So he doesn't find a complete example.
Yeah, I just don't know one. I mean, one may be known, I just don't know of it. Yeah. So in principle, you could expect different maxima. Yeah.
Main question. This conductor was property of the UV, and if you try to shift it by a contour term, you demand that the theory would make sense. After you compactify it on a circle, it's restricted the shift to be made.
I don't compactify it on a circle. I compactify it on a non-trivial three-manifold with a non-trivial gauge bundle. So, for example, one good manifold that you can use is S2 times S1. And then you can put a unit of flux through the S2, and then you can try to do large gauge transformations around the S1, and that gives you the quantization condition. But I want to emphasize that the contact terms are, they have this sort of, a bit like an anomaly, they have this sort of UV-IR, they have both a UV part and an IR part. So the fractional part, I argued, is IR, and the integer part is UV. So I don't want to say that the whole contact term is a UV thing. It's definitely not.
Mm-hmm. What I was trying to ask doesn't make sense. Suppose you should try to demand and theory make sense on a compact space with some domain work. Everything that you charge under this global machine is a jump at some point if you make cross it. That's changed the demand it. You shifted.
I don't think so. I mean, this would be a very different situation. I mean, the argument with a curved manifold is just a crutch to give a physical reason for why the quantization condition is what it is. I mean, at the end of the day, we're still studying the theory in flat space and its vacuum state. I should also say that there are slightly different arguments for these quantization conditions that have appeared in the condensed matter literature long ago that don't necessarily rely on putting the theory on a complicated space.
Maybe
okay. That's a good idea. Any other questions?